All right. Thanks, you guys. Oh man, maybe it's, I don't, do I need to explain this? I just felt like I was feeling all the feels this morning. And at some level, of course, that's just kind of, fun in the sense that you feel alive when you feel, and that's important. And Tim and Jane, if I had been standing at the back of a physical room this morning and you two had done the same thing, the same banter, the same songs, the same interaction that you did online, I would have been just a mess. Like, honestly, I would have been laughing way too loud and crying way too messy and, whatever, not following the social rules of decorum necessarily, because I was just feeling very, very connected this morning, and loving that, I'm just loving that. And I think, I mean, there's lots of factors, right? But but at the center of it for me, this morning, as I kind of reflected on it briefly, was this delight. I would say just absolute joy that we get to do this at all, and that we get to do it together is so remarkable. If you're someone that joins us by podcast, and I know there's a number of folks that do and only join us that way, good morning to you too. And know that you are in mind and heart and as joined as anyone can be through all of these different media. Happy Father's Day, Tim. For what it's worth, I'm not getting a guitar either. Oh my word. Anyway, that was cracking me up. I hope it's okay that you're not getting a guitar. Oh, well, anyway, hugs from kids and cards and, whatever might be part of your reality on Father's Day, maybe connecting with your father, maybe connecting with somebody that feels like they've been a significant figure in your life in terms of formation as a person, whether that's your father or somebody else. Lots of ways to mark a day like this, not just one. I think that's important to acknowledge and affirm. I also want to acknowledge that when we gather on the original lands of the Anishinaabe, the Cree, the Oji Cree, the Dakota, and the Dene peoples, and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. That's true, I think, whether we name it so or not, that's a matter of history. These next parts are opt-in parts. I will use we language. I wish to respect people's choice in this and also strongly encourage and affirm what I'm about to say. We respect the treaties that were made on these territories. We acknowledge the harms and mistakes of the past, and we dedicate ourselves to move forward in partnership with Indigenous communities and with Indigenous friends, with our kin, in a spirit of reconciliation and collaboration. As one of my first sort of thoughtful mentors around this truth and reconciliation challenge once reminded me, you can't reconcile a relationship you don't have. And so he said to me, as an Indigenous person speaking to a white person, if you don't know any Indigenous people, you might want to start there. Indeed. Indeed. I feel fortunate in our community that that we can have community members and friends at the table that are Indigenous as well and enjoy our friendships around the table of things like race and indigeneity and ethnicity and gender and sexuality and, the gamut of human beings. We didn't do anything in particular to mark Pride Week. I know that within that community, within the LGBTQ plus community, I've encountered in my friends throughout that community mixed responses to that week. Many people saying this is progress. Other people objecting to the way that week has been co-opted by industry or by marketplace dynamics, and so on. So lots are to be sensitive to, but certainly also an opportunity to affirm that gender and sexuality are part of being fully human, and not a boundary that we step across and become something other because we don't conform to a particular norm or previous, or for that matter, current standard. Breathing together this morning. That's a lot of preamble. But again, for what it's worth, that's the stuff that just sort of comes out of me, out of my heart spontaneously in the morning. That's not in the notes, if you will. For our breathing together this morning, whatever practice works for you, if you participate in this part of our gathering, you know what to practice. I'll use if you're a regular, because it frees me to not think about my breathing. But what I'm going to do is just set aside some time, and what I want to encourage, and choose again as you wish, but what I will encourage this morning is that we breathe in hope this morning. So just take a deep breath on behalf of those who need some hope. Maybe that's you, in which case start there. As we are reminded in Christianity's sacred texts, it's very difficult to love somebody else if you don't love yourself. And so if you're the person that needs hope, breathe in hope for yourself. Breathe out the things that assail hope. Exhale despair. Exhale discouragement. I'm not saying those things aren't real. I'm not saying this is about denial. I'm saying it's about consciously choosing how we approach that. So breathe out those things. If they're breathed out on your behalf, great. If you're breathing them out for someone else, beautiful. So exhale the things that assail hope and inhale hope. And we'll spend a few moments breathing together. And then we'll go exploring, because that's what we do. All right. Be comfy. Put your feet flat on the floor. Let your hands rest somewhere where they're at ease. Let's breathe together. Peace, everyone. Thank you. Good to breathe in hope with all of you. Today we are going to spend a little more time making friends with doubt than we did last week. If you were here or you've listened to that talk you bet in the intervening week, you might remember that we were talking about something that I called the stage before the stages. We were talking about stage zero. And we explored that stage when we did, because it's the one we all have in common. We all start there. We talked a bit how it might be experienced in the various categories. It'll be guiding our inquiry through the other stages. And in that process, we took the time to go through all of those categories and get to know them, and also sort of outline by name, at least, the different stages. If you want to see a review of the categories that we're using to examine the stages, there's a list posted on the Facebook page from last week, and in due course I'll post some comparative lists of the content that goes with each stage, but not just yet, because at least if you're like me, sometimes, you know, you read ahead and then we don't listen to the dialogue, we don't listen to the conversation. So I'll put that up when we're done talking about things today. One of the first things we need to do in this process is we need to take on the problem of using something like stages at all. Some of us have been uncomfortable with that idea right from the first moment that I mentioned it. Stages, models, schema, that all just falls under, like, yuck. That's just not appealing. I mean, why not? Well, they slam people into boxes. They fence us in. They give us tools that we can use to judge and dismiss others. They equip us to assess our own progress and the progress of others in comparative ways. And they just generally have built into them the danger of oversimplifying complex human experiences. All true. Those are problems. There is nothing magical about the model that I've introduced. There are all kinds of problems with it. Stage models, in particular, are vulnerable to making complex, swirling life experiences into some kind of vertical ladder-climbing structural game or path. And you know, you work your way through the stages, you get to the end of the game, you get a prize or bragging rights or something. If you grew up around Bible verses, you might still be able to recognize or even recite one about fighting a good fight, running a good race, and getting an award or a prize from God, depending on your translation. It's hard to know how to illustrate this stuff so we can have a shared conversation about it. That's not a new problem, of course. People have been wrestling with how to do this for as long as we've been self-conscious, I expect. I don't want to go so far down this path that we can't find our way back, but sometimes there's real benefit in wandering until you're good and lost. Hopefully that won't be exactly the way this goes this morning, but I do want to point out something that's right in front of our faces that we might otherwise miss. If we were to pause to think about the history of stage theories or other models for human change or methods of provoking or illustrating that kind of change, we might end up tracing back European thought history all the way to the Greek philosophers. The author of that verse that I just mentioned was Paul, the biblical writer Paul. Paul was a well-educated person in their time. They were trained to think at or near the zenith of the Roman Empire. And we won't come back to this, but if you remember Paul's story, we're going to get into stage one stuff today. And one of the features we'll find there is the way stage one puts things into two categories. You might remember in Paul's story, as we have it in the Christian texts, that he was pretty great at putting things into categories and making things them and us, and not moderating that approach very much. That is, among other things, a reflection of the way Paul had been taught to think. He knew about models for human development as conceived by the Greeks, subsequently by the Roman, and on throughout the history of European thought and to kind of right here, right now. The Bible, especially the New Testament portion of the Bible, the Second Testament, was written by people trained in this way of understanding the world, including our spiritual experiences of it. So there's often a kind of built-in or assumed linearity about those texts that reflects that mindset, that reflects that way of thinking. So if we did trace this back, we would find lots of different models for human change and development. Most of us here in the 21st century, in this part of the world, have been educated in systems that bear the deep imprint of that history of ways of thinking and knowing. That's not necessarily a problem, and often much to the good. So we might be both familiar with these ways of learning or knowing, and we might also have been exposed to enough of them to be conscious of their limitations and or suspicious of ways that they can be abused. We've been there, we've seen that, we've encountered some of its problems, which is one good reason why we need to be aware of other ways of learning and knowing, or other ways of thinking about and experiencing change. It's not so we can toss one way out and gulp down another. It's so we can expand our ways of knowing and growing as persons. Cultures older than those of the Greeks, open for discussion, but have been learning things from the dawn of time. Because learning is one essential aspect of what defines us as human. We are the animals that learn. And those cultures have been preserving those learnings along the way, typically in what are called oral traditions, by telling stories and passing along the stories. And sometimes, as with several Aboriginal groups in what we now know as Australia, those stories have been carried forward in the form of songs. And I've talked about this before. It's such an intriguing idea to me. I continue to find the idea of remembering geography in particular as a song just absolutely delightful. The idea that if you felt lost or disoriented, you could sing your way home, kind of just lights me up. Here on this continent, in this community, we've had the privilege of being taught in some of those forms. We've had the privilege of being taught by ancient stories that carry truths about human experiences, including spiritual experiences that we can all identify with, whether those are stories we would think of as our stories culturally or not. Most recently, we've watched and listened as Wally shared stories about stages of development and human growth using the medicine wheel. I don't know if you thought about that as a lesson on stage theory, and the stages of human development, but that wheel is distinctly a description of stages of change in life. Now, it's not stages. And it's not a grid. It's not a spreadsheet. One of the things about that wheel that fascinates me, other than the fact that it's a circle, which is pretty interesting all in itself, is how it's assembled entirely out of the stuff of the earth, and most particularly out of plants and stones. And that just feels really different than a grid or a spreadsheet, right? It's about human development, though. That's one legitimate lens on all of that. So in our movement through the information about these stages that we're using, I want to suggest another way of imagining how this works that's less grid-oriented and more interconnected and organic. Think of it maybe as being more from the garden and less from the strategic planning department. I don't know. All right, anyway. And then next week, we're going to explore a third sort of visual metaphor for this. But if you're part of the, you know, give me the comparative content crowd, not to worry. There will also be a grid. All right. So our yard has several large old trees on it, and in particular, some really grand old oak trees, just real giants in this part of the world. And last year, one of those old oak trees was at the dying, mostly dead part of its journey, and it was becoming a significant safety hazard. Because it had these massive branches that sometimes came down in wind or snowstorms, branches the size of, you know, trees. And so something needed to be done. And in the final event, I figured out a way to safely cut it down. The stump, which is still here, is over 2 feet across. I haven't taken the time to count the rings yet, but I wouldn't be at all surprised to see something in the hundreds. It was a sad experience to cut it down, even though I knew that it needed to be done. Those rings tell stories. And they tell stories about more than just years. They tell the story of the different seasons of that tree's life. In this climate, where things don't grow uniformly because, you know, right now it's everything's exploding with growth, but there's a season where that doesn't happen. So if you look at the rings of a tree in this climate, you're going to see that there are darker, thinner lines or rings. Those represent the dormant season. And what's happening in the dormant season for a tree is that it's consolidating the previous year's growth. And then there are lighter, typically wider rings that show the time of year when the tree was in growth mode, when the change was happening and the substance was being added. Each of those rings embraces and builds on the previous one, while also growing beyond its limits. Each ring, this is the important part in our context, I think, each ring both includes and transcends its predecessors. Not either or, both and. It both includes and transcends its predecessors. By the way, our brains do something similar to this tree ring thing. I just heard a documentary about this past week. That about the importance of resting when we're learning something, of taking breaks, when we're, like in this case, they did the research with someone practicing piano and learning a piano piece. And that when we take even short breaks, our brains consolidate the learning activity that's been happening while we've been trying to acquire the new skill. And it consolidates things. That's lovely enough in itself. Here's the crazy part. When we take a break, when we kind of go dormant, to use the tree analogy, our brains consolidate information up to 10 times faster than they're processing it when we're actually trying to learn things. So it's like your brain on turbos when we rest, when we take a break from active learning. Isn't that amazing? So same kind of thing, right? All right. If we were to connect this to the stage schema that we've been using, stage zero, which we talked about before, stage zero would be that center ring that would be right at the center of the tree, and then stage one would be next to it, and then stage two and stage three and so on, sort of concentric rings going outward from that center. And in this kind of understanding, the interdependence of the rings is, I think, pretty obvious, as is the idea that you really can't have one without the others. You really can't skip a ring, even though the rings won't necessarily be uniform or tidy. They just come one after the other. That's the only way it happens. Some seasons will be harder than others. There's going to be times of rapid growth and development, and there will necessarily, and even importantly, positively, importantly, be times when there isn't anything new apparently happening at all, when we're basically paused to solidify or consolidate the more rapid changes that have been taking place. So if you think about this in terms of spiritual formation or our growth as persons, that's a very hopeful metaphor or image. There's lots of other models that take this into account as well, but the idea that just because we don't feel like something is happening or that growth is happening or change is happening, that feeling is not necessarily a good barometer for what's really going on. All right, with that in mind, let's spend a little bit of time talking about the transition from stage zero to stage one. I'm going to do that, as I did with stage zero, by referencing the way that we develop physically as human beings, and in particular, in this case, the way our brains develop. So one way we can imagine our brain development is by thinking of our brains as functioning by committee. Now, depending on if you've ever been on committees and how that went, that might not be a happy analogy. I'm not sure. I once heard somebody say, oh, this is so churchy, so forgive me. No, if you need to plug your ears and not get triggered, just go ahead. But for God so loved the world that he didn't send a committee was the church joke. All to say, it reflects poorly on committees, right? Committees are not necessarily thought of fondly. But we can think of our brains that way. We can think of them as functioning by committee, or if you don't like committees or they've been traumatic, then as having modules. When we're born, our survival module is already at work. And the job of that module is to be the control center for our unconscious instinctive bodily functions, things like our heartbeat, our breathing, our lungs working, the active part of our digestive system, our basic reflexes, our alertness to danger. That module kicks in sort of right away. Shortly after birth, though, our intuitive belonging module kicks into gear. And that's the part of our brain that's focused on relationships. So for us as babies, as stage zero persons, this is absolutely essential to our survival because we're basically helpless when we arrive, right? So no relationships, no survival. And this is why we tell the story of the baby was found on the steps, abandoned, as, you know, the good news is that it was found. Why? Because without having been found, it wouldn't have survived. We need one another. We need relationships at stage zero to just live. For most of us, somewhere around age two, our meaning module or our intellect cranks it up into a different gear. And this is the part of us that can learn language. This is the part of us that can ask a zillion questions to help us make sense of the world. This is the part of us that begins to make independent judgments like, I want that toy and I want it now. Or judgments like, that's not fair. We've got at least one kid in our house who has had a deeply attenuated sense of injustice from the moment this module, you know, engaged. So I just saw on Facebook this past week, Aaron and Tasha's youngest just turned two. And when I saw that birthday message, I remembered thinking, oh, oh, this is where it gets super interesting. And I realize interesting can be a euphemism for many things, including terrible. But what I remember most about our kids at that age is that there was this explosion of language and thinking and expression of the self that seemed to come with a bottomless supply of energy and willpower. I remember the language, I mean, partly because words intrigue me, but I remember feeling like with all of our kids, like, you didn't have that word yesterday. And here you are today, like, not just with a new word, but with a new word that you just used contextually in a sentence. Wow, you know, it's crazy what happens in here. If you've been around or you've parented a two-year-old and you're like me, you might find it easiest to remember the clash of the wills that sometimes goes with those early expressions of independence. So mine is a pretty common version, a pretty common expression, or the expression of resistance to being directed when a preference is thwarted. Really, why do we think that the candy bars are at our knee level in the checkout line at the grocery store? Because that's eye level for a two-year-old. And most parents are not going to die on that hill while they're also trying to get their groceries into their cart and get through the checkout line. Oh, my dear. Anyway, so let's just say it's not a gold star parenting day and we cave in and we buy the Snickers bar. And then on the way to the car, the guilt sets in, right? If it waits that long, I'm a terrible parent. I should have said no. I should have stuck to what I told my two-year-old before we hit the lineup, which was, you can have a treat as soon as we get to the car. by which I meant a piece of fruit, but they didn't know that. I had a plan. Why didn't I stick with the plan? Well, part of what's going on here is that as the parent become, or rather, as the child becomes increasingly independent, the parent's job changes. And it's no longer enough to just provide for our child's needs and desires. This new dynamic is that we are now responsible for teaching the child how to provide for their own needs and desires in ways that we understand to be appropriate. So, if we switch lenses for just a little bit here and we think of this from the vantage point of our experiences as a child, what happens is that our parents and other significant adults start teaching us as children that some ways of meeting our needs and desires are appropriate and some aren't. And the way that happens is that we discover that some of those ways are rewarded and some are discouraged. So, for example, we get rewarded for acceptable social behaviors. We get rewarded when we smile, we say thank you, we share. I was in a meeting this past week with four other people, all of whom are counselors or therapists. I was not a client. all women, and listening to that group of women talk about the ways in which they were socialized around some of these things, what got rewarded for them because of their understood gender as women, and what got punished or discouraged. It was incredibly powerful and intriguing moment for me because the contrasts were powerful. Keep your eyes down. Don't be too loud. Don't be too powerful in a room full of men because you'll distress them. Things like that. All to say, when we're in this mode, in this stage, we learn what's acceptable social behavior and what isn't. So if we smile, say thank you, keep our eyes down, behave with decorum, whatever it is we're being taught, if we do this, the big people are going to respond one way. But if we, you know, scream, steal, bite, hit, take up our space, however we want to talk about this, so those, you know, they can be obviously distressing things like scream, steal, bite, or hit, but they can also be things that when we look back on them later, we reconsider. We'll get to that. If we do the things that are not rewarded, the big people are going to respond a different way, right? So this is all part of the big people agenda to help us learn how to survive independently in human society and in the natural world by learning the difference between right and wrong, between good and bad, between safe and dangerous, between appropriate and inappropriate, between permitted and prohibited. So that's sort of what's going on developmentally. So for us to become fully independent adults someday, we need to all start out as fully dependent for many things, including, in the early going, the guidance of older, wiser, big people. They make the rules, we follow them. We ask questions, but why? And they answer them. They give commands, we obey them. We have problems, they solve them. You might recall that stage one, which we're describing the beginnings of here, is a stage we're calling simplicity. And that's because the centerpiece of stage one is this simple mental function of sorting almost everything into one of two categories. Is this berry edible or inedible? Is this supper edible or inedible? Is this person my friend or my enemy? Is taking your friend's toy from them permitted or prohibited? Is lying or using violence a clever and effective way to get what you want? Or is it a punishable offense? Does this thing that I'm doing or this experience I'm having make me happy or sad? Does it make me mad or does it make me glad? In stage one, to kind of sum that, we're working at mastering the mental skills of dualism. Now, as a model, that's pretty simple, but it isn't always easy. Being told, no, you can't, or yes, you must, is a bit of a shock to the egocentricity of stage zero, where coddling and being given what we cried for was, you know, the norm. So when we enter this stage, in many ways, we're encountering a disruption of innocence, and it's being disrupted by a new responsibility, which could be summed up as figure out what the big people want, figure out what they reward, and figure out what they punish. In stage one, the big people, who soon include not only parents and primary caregivers, but also extended family, teachers, religious leaders, cultural leaders, these people, this group of people become central to our world. They are the people who know the rules, and they are the people that show them to us. They're also the ones that reinforce the rules. So stage one is the stage of authority as well as the stage of dualism. In stage one, as far as we're concerned, if we're in that stage, the authorities know everything and we don't, and so we're dependent on them. We trust them, we want to please them, and want to someday be as all-knowing and certain as they appear to be. So many places we could go with this. I better stick to my notes. Along the way, we learn that our big people dislike or distrust some other big people. So now we add a new category to our list of dualisms. We add us versus them. Our big people are good. Their big people are bad. We are right. They are wrong. Familiar and similar is safe. Unfamiliar and different is dangerous. So this is basically the social expression of dualism, and it creates a strong sense of loyalty and identity among whoever the us is, and a strong sense of anxiety and even hostility about whoever the them is. And by the way, there's nothing easier for an algorithm to work with than ones and zeros. And so it's hardly a surprise that the digital version of social expression tends to amplify this dynamic of us and them in lots of ways. Most of the people that most of us know were born and then raised into stage one. There are for sure cultures where this model really wouldn't fit, non-dual, sort of right from go. But in this part of the world, at this moment in history, they are, I think it's fair to say, they are not the common ones. Mostly what we mean when we talk about being raised is about being taught the dualisms of stage one. Now, there are lots of folks who spend their whole lives in stage one. They submit to the authorities, they follow the rules. If they become authorities themselves, they tend to demand the same submission from the next generation that they themselves gave to the previous one. It's simple, and it works great when it comes to things like faith and religion. And what I mean by that is this. For millions of us humans, millions and millions who have grown up around the big three monotheistic religions, so for Jews and Christians and Muslims, in particular, God is understood in terms of personhood. In other words, God is someone. They are the big person. They are the father. They are the patriarch in the sky. They are the one who ultimately sets the rules, who demands trust, who requires obedience, who hands out punishment when the rules are broken. God, in this understanding, authorizes human big people to exercise delegated authority, whether that's in the home, the faith community, or in government. Probably one of the clearest models for this, one of the most dramatically illustrated models for this culturally, would be, ancient models would be the Egyptian culture. Pyramids. If you ever see a diagram of Egyptian spirituality, you will see the divine figure above the pyramid. Then you'll see the pharaoh at the top of the pyramid. That's the delegated human right there, the big person that's delegated by the divine. And then the structure kind of goes down toward the bottom of the pyramid, you know, the ordinary folks from there. Also the structure of Hebrew belief, of early Judaism, and subsequently, in really obvious ways, of Christianity. And of course, the Muslim story shares its patriarchal narrative with Judaism and with Christianity, right? So anyway, that's kind of that picture. Now, that whole government idea that, you know, God delegates whoever's in charge and we should listen to them like we would listen to God. A year ago, I probably would have said that I think that that's more of an American idea than a Canadian one, but that was before I had to live through the church and state weirdness around vaccines. This dynamic, although it takes different forms and different cultural settings and moments, is very much alive and well right here, right now. Thanks very much. Now, sometimes it shows up in the kind of the vote this way because this person is God's candidate ideas, by which we usually mean this person's stated beliefs on particular moral issues or cultural issues is aligned with mine, and I believe I'm a God's person. But it can also take the form that's pretty much the opposite, as in this person slash government is against God, is the enemy of God's persons or people. This government is evil. So just a moral judgment that has a vertical characteristic to it, the ultimate figure of which is the divine or God. So those kind of things. So it's here. In any case, the upshot of all of this is that God, this sort of God is the big person in the sky dynamic, is if we trust our authorities enough to believe them and to do what they say, our understanding in this stage is that we can have the same certainties that they have. The certainty that we're the good people and all who are not part of our group are the bad people. Where do we actually think the phrase be on the right side of history, is rooted? That's that idea. All right? We can be certain if we align ourselves with these authorized authorities that we will have a happy ending and the bad people will not. Because part of our being the good people means that we will spend our lives trying to set the matter straight. We will spend our lives either avoiding, excluding, eliminating, or converting the bad people, because in the end, in this view of the world, it's either us or them. Yep. And again, like watch the news about any sort of religious group pushing back against the government, and you will see with crystalline clarity the illustration of the us-them dynamic around an issue like that. Now, here's a question. Does any of this help us understand how people who thought of themselves as good folks doing good work could end up running a school system that abused and killed Indigenous children? Please hear me correctly. I'm not saying, does any of this help us excuse or condone such a thing? I'm asking, does any of this help us understand how it could have happened? I leave that for further reflection. In many ways, though, that feels like a not quite right note to end this exploration on. So, let me just see if I can sum this up a little bit. Stage one. And again, I'll post the grid after we're done, and so you can sort of see all the categories and their features summed up. But stage one teaches us things that we need to know and understand. It's the stage that moves us out of the utterly self-absorbed reality of stage zero. It's a very important stage. For lots of people, stage one is home base for their whole lives, but not for everyone. For many other people, the stage that felt like the school that helped us learn the basic morals necessary for independence can start to feel less like it launches us into freedom or independence and more like it's caging us in. We start to see the limits. We start to see the places where it fails. We start to see the sometimes horrific outcomes of a lens on the world that insists that the way that lens sees things is the only right or true way to believe, and that the only way the world can become a better place filled with safe people is if they all hold that set of beliefs. In other words, we start to doubt it. Now, when we're in stage one, doubt can feel like an enormous problem. It can feel like an upset of the whole system. It can feel like a betrayal of our trusted authorities, of our caregivers, of our parents. It can start to feel like we're teetering on the brink of things like losing our salvation. In fact, we may be told outright in some settings that we're not teetering on the brink at all, that we've gone over it, that we have backslidden, we have lost our faith, we need to repent, we need to bow our knee, we need to, and so on and so forth. Well, millions may disagree, but I wish to say with as much clarity as I can that my experience has been that we do not need to be afraid of doubt. That doubt is not an enemy. In fact, doubt's not even neutral. It may be distressing. It may be deeply troubling. It may launch us into spaces that we've never been in before. But it is our friend. And the reason that I would say that doubt is our friend is because doubt, as we've talked about before, is catalytic, or at least it can be. Doubt can be the guide that helps us find our way from the stage that we're in to the next stage. And remember our tree metaphor? We're not abandoning one so we can gulp down the other. We're not trying to not have those other rings. We do have them. And when we think about the stage zero to stage one movement, we can see that they're essential, that we need the stage that comes after the one before. That's how we move. That's how we grow. It's how we change. But when we're being pushed against the edges of the stage that we're in, it does not necessarily feel like doubt is our friend. It can feel absolutely alarming, frightening, confusing, confounding, like we're breaking the rules. And we've been taught, stage one has taught us, that it's keeping the rules that makes you a good person. That can be a scary space. Do not be afraid. Doubt is not our enemy. Doubt is our friend. Doubt is the catalyst for change and for growth. And change and growth are natural and good. So that's where we're going to pick things up next week. All right? We're going to leave that there. Thanks for listening. Thanks for joining together in our exploration of what we believe. I'm so glad we get to do this together. Can't even tell you. All right, till next time. Peace. Bye for now.